Welcome to the Sounds of Success, brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Now here's your host, Mark Graydon.
Hello, DAPMA members, and welcome to the Sounds of Success. I'm Mark Graydon. This month, we look into the minds of our female students. The way a woman is going to react in a self-defense situation is very different than a man based on the way society conditioned women to behave. The same goes for their interaction in a classroom setting learning self-defense. On today's show, clinical psychologist and black belt Dr. Gia Rosenblum is here to discuss the psychology of teaching self-defense to women. And in a moment, Toby Milroy will be checking in with the marketing minutes for this month, so stay tuned. But first, let's start out by looking at the NAPMA Innovations DVD, where the compass and roadmap are in full use, guiding our way to success. This month, we joined the children's class of yet another exceptional children's instructor to come from the ranks of Mile High Karate. Matt Young, as you will see, is an instructor who is clearly having as much fun as his students. His upbeat and fun personality is contagious, and he contributes directly to the high retention numbers he records in his school. And in a 10th anniversary Joe Lewis conference preview, Mike Lee Kanarek teaches Israeli knife defenses. The Joe Lewis Black Belt Research Conference is a gem on the martial arts events calendar every year, and presenters like Mike Lee Kanarek are the reason why. His brand of knife defense is tested and upgraded on a continuing basis by Israeli military and special forces. This month's Easy Defense segment teaches one of the key drills in adrenal stress conditioning. The Portal of Safety drill allows a student to experience and perform under the adrenal rush. Getting your students to actually perform while adrenalized is one of the most powerful ways you can teach your students to be effective in a real-life altercation. And this month, in our bonus segment, we bring you a preview of the upcoming Diamond Nationals Karate Championship. On behalf of NAPMA, Joe Corley interviewed the founders of the event, martial arts icons Pat and John Worley, about the positive impact tournament competition can have in your school. As you will hear, they run very successful schools, and tournament competition has been a driving force in motivation and energizing their student base for many years. So it's fun martial arts for kids, knife defenses from Israel, adrenal stress training for self-defense, and an interview with the founders of the Diamond Nationals, and you can find it all on the NAPMA Innovations DVD this month, so be sure to check it out. Next up, NAPMA COO Toby Milroy knows a thing or two about marketing. In fact, he has tactics, a roadmap, if you will, to guide you through the marketing plans for this season, so let's listen in.
Well, hello, NAPMA members. This is Toby Milroy again with your monthly marketing minute. And since this is August, we're all in full-scale back-to-school mode, especially for family-oriented locations. Now is a very fruitful time for our marketing activities. If you've been aggressively implementing the summertime marketing strategies that we teach our members, you'll have accomplished two very important things in June and July. You'll have accomplished, number one, having some great enrollment months due to the community involvement activities and those marketing systems that we coach and teach to our members. Second, you'll have accumulated a massive lead list. Many school owners are reporting to us that they've accumulated 200, 300, 500 leads or even more. And now is the time to take those leads and really be super focused on converting those leads to brand new paying students. The question often arises, how do I most effectively capitalize on such a big lead list? And in reality, it's a combination of three or four or five different media that you need to be using to accomplish a high conversion rate from such a large lead list. We have to think back to our lesson in Direct Response Marketing 101 when we talk about the Parthenon Principle. And the Parthenon Principle obviously identifies that our marketing activities should look like a Parthenon. We should have many, many pillars of lead generation and student acquisition marketing activities driving leads into our school. But at the same time, we should think about capitalizing on our current warm lead lists in the same manner. We should be using a Parthenon of different activities for that list as well. So not only in acquiring the list, but how we follow up on the list. Obviously, direct mail is a very fruitful activity during the back-to-school season, as you'll be entering into the conversation that your prospects are already having in their mind. Many families are right now in the mode of scheduling out their school year so they can make time for all of the extracurricular activities and the outside school programs that they're going to be getting their families involved with. And if I'm an adult-oriented school rather than a family-oriented school, the same thing is happening in that prospect's mind. They're considering what activities, now that they're back from their summer vacations or they're getting more and more focused on their work year, they're also having the same conversation in their mind. What am I going to do for the rest of the season? So now is certainly a time that you want to be in their mailbox and you want to be constantly dripping on that lead list, making sure that they think of you when they're thinking of what am I going to do for the school year. Obviously, email and voice broadcasting are important media that you can use to attract that market. However, what we've found is the absolutely most effective and efficient method to convert the highest percentage of these leads to paying students is actually meeting the people. And since we can't go to everyone's house individually, we have to use the telephone. This is a great opportunity to set your program director loose on a huge list of potential prospects. And we've made your life easier by facilitating and handing to you on a silver platter a few proven systems to help you convert the highest number of these leads. Step number one is to have your monthly calendar filled with lots and lots of activities that would be attractive to a new prospect. In your monthly marketing package, you'll find done-for-you marketing campaigns to help fill your calendar for the back-to-school season. You could hold an anti-abduction class in your school. You could hold a focus and confidence-building course or a character development program, something that could really help you drive those prospects who are already thinking about how they're going to prepare for back-to-school into your martial arts school as a precursor to beginning the school year. It's our recommendation you have a very robust calendar of lots of exciting events that gives your program director a great excuse to reach out and make contact with each one of your prospects, and then simply convert the conversation into an info call. This is a great time of the year to be in the martial arts school business, and this is a great time of the year to attract a huge number of new students who we can really help build a great future for. Obviously, our product and our service is much more valuable than that of the average sport or activity many children get involved in. So it's our duty and our responsibility to the community to make sure we can attract as many students as humanly possible into our academies where they can have such a much more robust experience. So I wish you a very successful, very prosperous back-to-school season, and I hope to see you at our event in the fall.
The way a woman is going to react in a self-defense situation is very different from a man based on the way society conditions women to behave. The same goes for their interaction in a classroom setting learning self-defense. On today's show, clinical psychologist and black belt Dr. Gia Rosenblum is here to discuss the psychology of teaching self-defense to women.
And talk about who your self-defense students are. Understanding them a little bit better, understanding some of the personal safety risks that are a little more specific to women, what your programming needs are going to be if you're going to be teaching self-defense to women, some of the specific issues and challenges that are going to present themselves to you with these particular people, and then some specific strategies for doing that. So we don't forget, I wanted to recommend at the very outset two books that I think are really extraordinary. One is called The Gift of Fear, by Gavin DeBecker. He was publicizing about 2 years ago. He's got a new book out now called Protecting the Gift. The Gift of Fear focuses on safety and personal safety for adults, targeted primarily at women, but absolutely equally applicable to men. Protecting the Gift talks about teaching personal safety to kids, teaching adults how to help their kids be safer. That's the thrust of the book. The third book actually is called Beauty Bites Beast. It's by a woman named Ellen Snortland. It is specifically geared towards the issue of teaching self-defense, full impact, full contact self-defense, and personal safety to women. It's a book geared towards women. So I would encourage certainly anybody in here who's planning on teaching self-defense to women to read these two books, and they're certainly excellent books to recommend to your students as well. Okay, so we know why we're here, we know what we're gonna talk about. Why are we gonna talk about this? Why bother? I always like to give people a reason for coming to my talks. So I wanna talk about why are these psychological issues relevant to you, what's important about it. Just generally speaking, why you're here this weekend is to enhance the excellence of your instruction, to deliver the best, highest quality possible instruction that you can. And I'm a psychologist, so I'm a little biased, but I don't think it takes a psychologist to recognize that understanding the psychological, emotional, personal issues in the work that you do is going to make you a better instructor. You also want programming that effectively serves its purpose. You want to accomplish your goals. I promise you, if you don't attend to the psychological and emotional issues in self-defense, very much relevant to what Peyton Quinn was doing, talking about managing that emotional reaction. It's a physiological reaction of adrenaline, but it's an emotional reaction of fear, of paralysis, lots of thoughts running through your mind, which I'll talk about in a little minute. That's relevant also. And if you don't address those issues in your training, you're not going to have the effect of helping your students escape, avoid, or be victorious in an event of violent crime. You also want to be sure that your programming doesn't harm anybody. You don't want students leaving your classes more frightened than when they came in. You don't want them leaving having false expectations of what self-defense or personal training safety is going to give them. You want to make sure that you are meeting them at a level that's appropriate. And of course, you want to increase the likelihood of success of your overall programming. You want people to leave your programs giving great word of mouth about how extraordinary it was, what a wonderful experience they had, how important it was for their friends and everybody they know to come in and take this training. And we'll talk about why that's so important a little bit more in a moment. And finally, as I said, this is a topic near and dear to my heart. I personally think that teaching self-defense and personal safety is an extraordinarily important responsibility. If you choose to take on this task, I really hope that you approach it with great seriousness. I approach the martial arts in general with great seriousness as a lifetime commitment to an art form, to training my body and training my mind, but I think that self-defense training goes to another level. Here we are actually talking about life and death, and so I think you need to take it that seriously. If you embark on a commitment to teach it with that in mind. So that's kind of my sales pitch for what I hope you're going to get out of today is really understanding a little bit more about each of those points. So again, to back up and ask that question, who are your self-defense students? Again, let's talk a little bit more specifically about women, but I want to know, how do they differ from students in your traditional martial arts or cardio karate classes or any other fitness class? Who are they? Why do they come to you? Why are they, and are they unique in any ways? Any thoughts about that? Do you have any sense? I'll tell you, but I'll ask first. Okay. We want to know about what are their unique needs. What do they come to you with that you're going to have to address? First of all, female students are different than male students to begin with. We're going to talk about women here for a moment. Any of the women in the audience remember their first martial arts class, the first time? Okay, anybody remembers feeling really weird? I personally remember feeling weird just making a fist. I don't think I had ever had a reason to make a fist before in my life. Then I had another really weird experience where I had progressed, I was maybe a month into training, and we had a different instructor that night in class, and he happened to be much more focused on self-defense aspects. And so in going through techniques, he was describing it, and then you bring the guy's head down onto your knee and break his nose. I'm like, break his nose? I'm not here to break anybody's nose. I'm here to get physically fit. I'm here to train my body and your mind. What are you talking about? But he was talking about the reality. He was talking about the other side of what we were doing in that class. As a woman, that scared me to death. So not even in a class like adrenal state training or Krav Maga or impact self-defense or other high contact personal safety trainings, just in a straight martial arts class, I was already confronting some of the unique issues that were there for me as a woman that were a little different for the men and the boys in the class who used to do a lot of rough and tumble play, who maybe played football or rugby or other contact sports, who were used to banging heads a lot more than I certainly was. And then I think it goes without saying that personal safety as a topic, Dr. Schubert brought up in her talk in the last hour, the shootings in Littleton, Colorado, everything that we see on the nightly news, the kinds of crime that might affect our own communities, those are issues that touch us deeply. Those are issues that evoke all kinds of emotional responses, whether you've been personally victimized or someone in your family or just in your neighborhood or if it's a stranger on the news, that evokes all kinds of reactions that are relevant here. We want to understand the concerns, the inhibitions, the fears of these people. So this was brought up a little bit this morning, the question of, we go to fitness clubs to improve our health so we'll live longer. We teach our kids how to swim so that if they're ever at the beach, they won't drown. We do all kinds of things to ensure our safety and well-being. A very small percentage of us take self-defense classes. Even people, and I work with people who whose occupations take them to high crime areas. I, as a psychologist, work with people whose jobs place them in the presence of violent, dangerous people because they have serious mental health problems and their behavior is unpredictable. Even many of these people don't take personal safety or self-defense classes. It seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it, that we would do this? This would be the next logical step in ensuring our health and well-being over the long term. Very few people do it. Why? Denial. What an extraordinary force in all of our lives. As long as we can keep it at arm's length, we can pretend it has nothing to do with us. Fear. Well, if we get ourselves out of that denial space, even for a little bit of a moment, we have to confront the reality that what we're talking about is terrifying. I don't know about you, but even after 10 years of martial arts and a lot of self-defense training, when I saw them do the demos up on the stage with that knife, and I had the image of that knife coming down the side, down the arm, and plunging into the ribs, that got me going a little bit. That was frightening to think about. It was frightening to contemplate. It put images and pictures into my mind that I don't want there. I don't want to have those images and pictures in my mind. So the fear combined with the denial makes it really hard for people to get themselves into classes that are going to force them to think about that stuff. Just embarrassment, just the idea of having to go up there, particularly for women, put yourself in an awkward situation, allow someone to make you feel vulnerable, maybe being afraid that, oh, I tried, but I'd never be able to do it well. I'd look like an idiot. Drenda was talking about this with adolescents, you know, always worried that they look like an idiot. But you know what? We don't outgrow all of that. We're all worried all the time about, you know, looking competent, looking reasonable in front of our peers. But also two very important things. For women, I think that they're very true for, the first is very true for men as well in some ways, but particularly potent is that women are socialized and very often taught that their role is not to be the victor. Their role is certainly not to be the aggressor. Their role is to be the one who is protected by someone else. That we are the damsel who will be rescued from the castle. That we will have a prince on a white steed in shining armor come up and take care of us. We're not socialized to believe that we possess the power within ourselves to be the victors. So very slowly, over years and years and years, it's inculcated into us on an unconscious level that we're really kind of helpless. And that's a hard belief to overcome. But let's say, for the sake of argument, you've got a class full of women. You know, why are they there? A woman who's taken the step to actually enroll in a self-defense class has done something to overcome all of these issues. Otherwise, she wouldn't be there. She wouldn't have put her foot in the door. So we have to wonder why. That's another step in understanding who your students are. How did they get there? Well, what are some of the issues that come up? Why would a person finally make that jump, be motivated to taking self-defense? Well, something has heightened, in many cases, that person's feeling of specific vulnerability. I need this now. I need this now like I didn't need it before. Sometimes it's simple. First class I took was in New York City. There were a large number of women who had just moved into the city. Maybe they lived in the Midwest, maybe they lived in the South, maybe they lived in just a small town in New York State. Now they were in the big city. They had a heightened sense of their own vulnerability. They felt fearful on a regular basis. They needed something to manage that anxiety. People talked about having new jobs, being in settings where they felt more at risk. Well, I work late hours, I have to walk alone to the parking lot, I don't feel that my building is very safe, that sort of thing. For some reason, their perception of their own risk has increased. Now, I'm not saying that that person's risk has necessarily increased in reality. That doesn't matter. Their feeling of risk has increased. Even more importantly, maybe there's been something that has affected them personally. There's a personal, an incident, an event, another individual that is now making them feel fearful. So in the case of a recent breakup, a stalking, some form of domestic violence are the kinds of things that immediately come to mind. But I've also talked to bosses who recently fired an employee and are feeling a little bit leery about how that person might react to that firing. Or they have a coworker that consistently harasses them or makes them feel uncomfortable in the workplace. Or the clientele that they work with on a regular basis. I know social workers who regularly go out into very destabilized neighborhoods where there's a lot of poverty and a lot of crime. They're going there to help. They're going there to bring services, to bring hope, but not everybody who greets them is really enthusiastically receptive to what they're bringing. So they are people who regularly confront potential for danger. Or something as simple as, you know, my neighbor's house was broken into yesterday. And that scared the bejesus out of me. I couldn't believe it. Or my friend walked in on an intruder, can you believe it, in her own home. Or somebody I know was carjacked. Or I don't like what's going on in my town. Or I think there's a gang forming among the adolescents in the high school. So all of those are potential reasons that someone might have heightened fear. But underlying all of that is the possibility that someone who comes into one of your classes has actually been victimized in one way or another. That something has happened to them personally or someone very, very close to them. That they themselves have had a history of assault or sexual assault, and of course there's a difference. You can be mugged or you can be raped, and anything in between can happen as well. Or maybe, again, it was a family or friend. It's really important that if you're going to instruct in these kinds of areas that you understand the statistics of probability and risk. Why? Because that's going to help you understand who your students are, and it's going to help you teach them the kinds of things they need to know for the kinds of situations they are most likely to find themselves in. You might teach me a whole lot of training that I might find useful if I was in the Israeli army, but if I don't join the Israeli army, I'm not going to really be using those techniques very effectively in my day-to-day life. This can make your training much more relevant to the people that you're teaching. So how likely is it that someone who comes into one of your classes might actually have been victimized? I'm really sad to say that it's highly likely. There's something called the National Criminal Justice Reference Service that you can access on the web very easily. So if you're fascinated by crime statistics, there are an infinite number of them available free of charge. You can find out a lot more information. But I wanted to just give you, as if you didn't already know, a little bit of information about violent crime. And as we start to go through these statistics, you'll start to see a basic fact, which is what is happening in violent crime differs from men to women. The Krav Maga folks talked about knowing what's happening in the fight, understanding the fight. The fight is a different fight for men and women very often. The statistical probability of what kind of a fight is going to happen differs. Generally, though, there are a lot of violent crimes. 8.6 million crimes in the US in 1997. That's 39 violent victimizations per every 1,000 people, and an additional 6.8 million murders per 100,000 people. The difference between men and women to a large degree is that women are 8 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted. There's a sexual component to the violent crime. I just want to remind people that rape is typically a crime of violence. It is not a crime of sexuality. It is a crime of power and control. But the way women are attacked for power and control often tends to include a sexual component of control. Aside from rape, men are much more likely to be victimized. But the type of victimization differs. So it might be robbery. It might be a single account of assault. It might be a confrontation that escalates into violence, that sort of thing. Younger people are more at risk. I don't know why this is true, but people are more at risk in the West for some reason. I'm sorry, but that happens to be the case. The typical assailant, importantly enough, tends to be a male, white, average age 18 to 34, but not the 6'2", 250-pound football player of my worst nightmare. That's not who the typical assailant is. The typical assailant is, in fact, of average height and weight. But a confounding problem is that they typically have used alcohol or other mind-altering substances prior to the assault. So you're often dealing with someone who's of an average stature, or below average stature, but has some sort of mind-altering substance driving some of their behavior, making them more unpredictable and out of control. Critically important point, the next one. Perpetrators of violent crimes are far more likely to be an acquaintance or a relative of the target than to be a stranger. The fact that someone is known to the target is a really critical issue here, and that's far more likely to be the case. So in the case of rape, they're known to the victim 68% of the time, 50% of the time in the case of other types of violent crime. And in particular, women are far more likely to be victimized by someone in their family than by a stranger. So again, that idea that we have, and I think that the fear idea that a lot of women have is of somebody who jumps out from behind the bushes. Somebody who's waiting inside your house when you turn the key and come home late at night by yourself. Somebody who's waiting in the parking lot for you that you've never seen before in your life and is simply there to victimize you. That does happen, unfortunately, but the probability is that it's someone who's known, not someone who's a total stranger. So more specifically talking about women and girls, I just statistically want you to recognize that a lot of crime doesn't get reported. You probably all know that. So you can sort of think about doubling these numbers in your mind as you look at them. highest rates of violent crime actually occurs to fairly young women between the ages of 16 to 24 years. So when you think about that college population, when you think about the high school population, these are unfortunately women and girls who are at some sense of risk. And then when you add to that the issue of adolescence, often feeling very invulnerable, feeling like they're kings of the world, feeling like nothing bad can happen to them, that becomes a pretty high risk group. Again, the whole issue of who's doing the assaulting tend to be people that women know. And in particular, over 1 million women are typically victimized by intimates. That's someone that they have been in intimate contact with, a spouse, a boyfriend, a lover, or someone formally in that role. Interestingly, you might think this is counterintuitive, but women who are victimized by someone they've been intimate with are more likely to be injured than someone who is victimized by a stranger. Urban women are a little bit more at risk for violence from a stranger, but with regard to violence within a family or within someone they know, urban and suburban women are at the same risk. I was also somewhat surprised to find what a problem stalking is. And that tends to be overlooked as a personal safety issue because people tend to think of stalking as nonviolent, but stalking can often escalate into violence. 1 out of 12 women has been stalked at some point in their lifetime. So if you know 12 women, likelihood is that one of them has had to deal with a persistent, inappropriate pursuer who has sought some kind of inappropriate contact with her. 25 to 30% of the time that escalates to violence, but more likely when there has been a previous intimacy. And murder is the outcome. In 29 to 54% of murder victims have been stalked and were often in battering or violent relationships. These are very unfortunate statistics, and I wish they were different. The reason that I'm telling them to you is because if you bring women into your self-defense classes, I think it's really important that you recognize the potential for them to have had a history of violence in their lives and the potential for a self-defense scenario in their lives in the future to play itself out with someone who is known to them, not the stranger who jumps out on the street. If the perpetrator is likely to be someone who's known to the victim, how does that happen? Well, it can happen in a bunch of different ways. You know, in one hand, someone might have targeted a particular woman. Maybe they noticed her, they were interested in victimizing them for some reason in some way, and they decided to make contact. And they, if those of you who are familiar with those terms, what we talk about in crime is that sometimes a perpetrator will actually interview his victim. He will approach them, he will begin to discuss things with them. He will try to get a sense of how passive is this person? How likely is this person to be compliant with me? How easily do they go along with my questions? How much information do they give to me? Do they allow me to invade their personal space and stand more closely than is appropriate? Do they give me more information than they should really be giving a stranger? There's a lot more information about that in the books that I mentioned to you. But the point is that the perpetrator sets out to get to know the victim, to decide that they are going to be probably an easy victim, and that's when things begin to escalate from the interview process into the potential for violence. In other situations, the person who ends up being violent didn't intend to be violent. I don't think that, you know, frequently men enter violent marriages or other types of relationships with the intention of being a victimizer, but that the potential for that is there, and that's what evolves over time. Very often when you're talking about situations where it's a known assailant, there's been a process over time by which lesser boundaries have been violated. So it wasn't that everything was hunky-dory and we had a wonderful relationship. There was great communication, a lot of mutual respect. This was a good, solid relationship. And then, bam, one day, I got punched in the face. One day, everything turned sour. Very often, there have been warning signs. There have been changes in the relationship. And I don't just mean a marriage. This could be a work relationship. This could be a collegial relationship, a friendship, an acquaintance relationship, but that slowly over time other boundaries were violent. So maybe the person started using inappropriate language. Maybe they began to refer, again, let's say it's a friendship or a work relationship, began to refer to the woman's body, refer to her clothes, make sexual innuendos, slowly push that boundary, slowly come closer to something really inappropriate. Maybe he began to, again, sit closer, move closer, touch, put the arm around, doing things that the woman might have felt very uncomfortable about, but for a reason we'll talk about in a second, she didn't feel comfortable saying, stop that right now, leave me alone, don't do that again. So the target person, and I'm using the word target here very specifically because the word victim implies that the assault has been successful and the woman was victimized. And target implies that it was the perpetrator who selected that person to be a target. That's why I kind of like that word. So if there's been a relationship over time, the target person may be kind of used to giving in. Maybe it's their boss and they feel like, God, if I draw a line in the sand, I'm going to lose my job. You know, or I really, this guy's giving me mixed signals, but I really think I kind of like him. I want to see if I can make this relationship work. I don't want to kick him out. You know, maybe he just had a bad day and that's why he's crossing those lines with me today. The perpetrator may also be in a position of authority, trust, or control, like a boss, like a colleague that you're sharing some kind of mutual responsibility with. You need to trust them. Your work depends on their work. It may be hard in those situations, especially when the other person is in authority, to recognize, you know, that's not an appropriate boundary. They're not. My boss isn't really allowed to talk about how I look or, you know, what my bedroom looks like. Or my coworker really, it's really not okay for him to be implying that I'm stupid and incompetent and I should do twice the work just to prove myself to him. But over time, if those boundaries get pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, it starts to be hard to think like, well, I really don't want him to be standing right here and touching me. You know, I let all those other boundaries go. It's hard to draw this one now. And finally, as is implied, the woman may feel that drawing that boundary and saying no and setting a firm limit is going to lose her something really valuable. And in the moment, it may be hard to set the boundary until things have gone pretty far because of that fear of some kind of greater loss. So what I've tried to give you here is a bigger picture of some of the relevant issues for women in self-defense situations. Again, it's not always black and white. It's not always the guy on the street that you know wants to commit a rape, that you know wants to commit a violent crime, or has a bias and this is a race crime and it's going to be a beating and it's clear and there's no fuzzy lines. Most of the time, there are fuzzy lines. So if you're going to teach self-defense to women, you've got to deal with those fuzzy lines. So I think that if you're going to teach self-defense to women, a really responsible program has to confront some of these issues. These are some goals that I think you really ought to have. You have to prepare women, obviously psychologically, for all the things that we just talked about, for the fact that they might have to use some of these strategies with someone they know, that they might get into an adrenalized state, not because, again, some guy jumps out with a broken bottle, but because some guy in their office that they see every day has suddenly done something that really freaks them out. You have to prepare them mentally for being in that situation. And then you have to prepare them for the idea that if that escalates, they might have to defend themselves physically against that type of person. Of course, ideally, you want to prepare women and everybody to recognize warning signs, to know when those boundaries are being crossed, to avoid danger, to set the boundary early and try to prevent it from being crossed, but also to recognize the signs that things are escalating, that they are not being heard, that their word no is not being listened to, and that that's a very important warning sign. I think it is critically important that you recognize that this is your responsibility if you teach self-defense to women. You are responsible for empowering them, for sending the message. You have the right to defend yourself. You are worth fighting for. Your life is valuable. Teach them all the skills in the world you want. Make them as physically fit as they can be. They can bench press twice their weight. I don't care. If they don't think they're worth saving, they won't fight. So if they come into your class and they trust you to teach them, you better teach them this lesson too, that they have a right to take action. And that confidence, that belief in her own ability to defend herself ought to be part and parcel of what you do in every class. And that goes for a weekend intensive class. That goes for someone who just comes into your martial arts program, but maybe you have a self-defense component built in. If you're teaching self-defense per se, these are messages you need to be sending. So I have my little friend down here saying, you know, what's so hard about that? So you say, you know, you go, girl. You defend yourself. You take care of yourself. You know, you have my permission. You knee that guy to the head. Okay, those are good messages. Those are powerful messages. But you have a problem. You have a lot to overcome. What do you have to overcome? You have to overcome everything on this list and a lot more. And I wrote this in script in little pretty pink flowers, you know, because these are girl things. Because girls are taught directly and indirectly in words and in actions and in images and in the media and everywhere they go for their entire lives, all of these things. The Krav Maga guy said this morning, You know, give him 5 minutes and he could teach a chimp to do an eye strike. I'm telling you, you could teach a chimp to do an eye strike in less time very often than you can teach a woman to say, no! Why? Because a chimp has not been taught for its entire life that it's not okay to say no. It's certainly not okay to yell. You've got a lot to overcome with women sometimes. Women are taught to be non-aggressive. They're taught to always be nice and polite, to consider everybody else's feelings but their own. Very often taught to be passive, to be nurturers. We're responsible to help people grow and flourish and to care for them when they're wounded. We're certainly not taught to wound. We're not taught to be the aggressors. We're taught a lot of physical things, too. And sometimes, again, sometimes we had moms that told us, you know, cross your legs, sit nice, sit like a lady. We're not taught to stand in a good firm stance, so you've got good balance with your knees bent so that you can not be knocked over easily. We're not taught to root ourselves in the ground. We're taught to be light and dainty and up on our toes and, you know, be like the ballerinas are. So when I say keep our legs together, I'm not talking about that in the sexual sense. I'm talking about that in the sense of we're taught to move in a certain way. We're taught not to take up too much space, to be kind of small. You see a lot of women, even adult women, standing, you know, very pigeon-toed, very demure, very much in the corner. Unfortunately, that's very much looking like an easy target of a person who's not going to fight back. We're also given this message that we're supposed to be very awkward at men's things. You know, it's not a surprise to hear somebody say, oh, you throw like a girl. Oh, you know? How could you be competent if you're expected to be incompetent? How can I go out there and do a manly thing and expect myself to be good at it when all my life I've been told, no, those are not the things that girls are good at. You can't do that. Unfortunately, what that translates into, we're taught to believe about ourselves, as I said before, that we're helpless, that we're kind of like very tall children in many domains of our lives. And finally, sadly, we're taught to be ashamed of our bodies. We're not taught to be proud of our bodies. We're not taught to feel good about what our bodies can do. We're often taught that they're not thin enough, certainly. We're taught that over and over again every day. We're taught that we're not attractive enough. We're taught that we're not young enough. We're taught that we're not tall enough and that we're not, you know, supermodel material. So we don't get a lot of encourage to go out there and use our bodies in powerful ways, to be strong, to use that muscle mass we've got in our hips and thighs. We're taught to like have that lipo sucked away and, you know, downplay it if at all possible, pretend we don't have hips and thighs, when in fact they are our most powerful weapons and when used in a self-defense setting can be devastatingly effective. Another critically important thing that is a byproduct to a certain extent of all of these things is that women are taught to shut off our own internal radar about what's right and what's wrong. We all know that feeling when the hair stands up on the back of our neck, and sometimes it doesn't take anything to trigger that feeling. I remember as an adolescent walking home from school one day, I was a block away, I saw two guys around the corner. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I knew I was in trouble. They were, you know, like a block away from me, and I knew I was in trouble. And I was walking home from school, as I continued on my way home, they crossed the street to be on the same side of the street as me, and then I really knew I was in trouble. And thank God, a neighbor of mine rounded the corner with his dog right at that moment. As I was thinking to myself, okay, you know, what could I do? I could run into the, I didn't know anybody who lived on that block, but I could run in and ring a doorbell, and if I'm gonna do that, I better make sure there's a car in the driveway so it looks like there's somebody home. I could pretend it's my house, like I'm using my key, and maybe they'll assume that I'm home and they, you know, can't get to me. I was using that thought process as quickly as I could. But very often, over time, we're taught to just shut that off, to discount, say, oh, don't be ridiculous. What would those guys want with me? They're a block away, they can't hurt me. Or a man approaches you on the street and asks you a question, or a babysitter seems to be behaving a little bit oddly, but you're, oh, you know, he's really a nice guy, or he's just trying to be helpful. I can't be rude and tell him to leave me alone and go away. I can't be rude. I'm not allowed to be rude to protect my life. I'm not allowed to listen to the voice inside my head. Gavin De Becker talks about this at length in The Gift of Fear in beautiful, beautiful language. Those messages are so powerful. And so that's another thing that you really need to overcome is giving the women the message that they have the right to listen to themselves. So I want to talk about some specific things as a result of some of these issues that can come up during a class. So you've got a class together. You've got women who've overcome their obstacles. They're in your class. What might happen? particularly if you're doing realistic scenarios, as we're describing this weekend with Krav Maga and the adrenal state training, some women might feel even more frightened and more vulnerable after a couple of classes. So here, you're really busting through that denial. You're showing them what it looks like to be assaulted. Maybe you're doing realistic assault scenarios where they are grabbed. Just the physical sensation of being grabbed, being pinned, being held forcefully can evoke all kinds of feelings of fear and vulnerability. It can trigger just negative thoughts and images, just like seeing a scary movie stays in your mind for the rest of the week. Same thing. If the class isn't handled well so that women are taught to kind of manage those feelings, it can really stick with them. You may see a woman out on the floor who's got dynamite skills, got a heel palm straight to the chin that just picks the guy right up off his feet, lands him on the floor, and yet she'll tell you after class, you know, I really don't feel like I can do this. I think I'm going to drop out of the class. I just know I'm no good. I could never do this. It's really too scary for me. So her feeling of self-efficacy, her belief in her own skill, is way out of sync with what you actually see in terms of her physical ability. I just want to go through some of the issues that can arise. We talked about that feeling of embarrassment, of awkwardness with doing men's things. So you may find that what seems pretty straightforward, take a good, stable stance, make eye contact, use your voice. Simple. Kids can do it. Chimps can do it. If you spent your whole life being taught this was really the way to be, this is really hard. So it may seem easy to you, it may be really hard for your students. Specifically, the more realistic the practice, particularly if you have a woman in your class who has had an assault history of any kind, that realism can trigger even more powerful thoughts and feelings in the form of very crystallized memories, memories that are kind of like, if you've heard the term flashback with regard to war trauma or other trauma, memories that actually contain with them not just a thought or an image, but a physical sensation, maybe a smell, maybe a sound, incredibly vivid as though it were happening right then. So the more realistic sorts of training you do, the more likely it is that these things can be triggered. And finally, outside of your classroom, don't assume that everybody's gung-ho for this woman to be taking your class. Her spouse, her boyfriend, her boss, her brother, I'm picking on men because this is typically where it comes from, but from women too, they might be getting messages like, oh, what are you going to do that for? You know, I could get you in a hole that you couldn't get out of. I don't care what they're teaching you over in that school. Come here, let me show you what you'd have to defend against if you were really on the street. Not, that's excellent, that's amazing, you take care of yourself, you have every right to defend yourself, your body is your property. I bet you they're not hearing those messages from everybody in their life. So you have to be giving those messages to counteract whatever they're hearing out in the world. And we already mentioned, of course, the possibility that the person has a history that you're going to have to contend with. But to go over some strategies, the first thing you need to do, and I hope I've convinced you of this, is acknowledge for yourselves that teaching self-defense is different from teaching other types of martial arts, and that you're going to have to do things differently. First recommendation, increase the privacy of these classes. If you're going to have students deal with these issues, you have to give them a very safe environment in which to deal with them, or they will leave your class, or worse, they'll be harmed. I'd rather they left, but they could be emotionally hurt by the experience. You really want to close your school to other activities. You don't want people walking back and forth when you're doing, you know, enacting rape scenarios with, you know, your students. If you've got a storefront window, cover it. Talk to your other students and your staff. Tell them this is not a time to come and conduct other business in the school. Discuss confidentiality with your students, and I'll talk about with your instructors in a second. You may want to have an agreement amongst the students, verbal or written, that what's talked about in this class stays in this class. If you've got a student who has an assault history, she wants to talk about it so she can deal with it. She wants to act out maybe succeeding in defending herself against the type of assault she experienced. You don't want that then discussed out in the community. You want the student to feel really safe about talking about those things with you. Again, you want to know who your students are. Inquire about their history. Have a pre-class interview. Have a confidential history form in which you ask them questions about, do they have a history of physical injury so you can keep their body safe? Do you have a history of an assault or some kind of psychological or emotional issue that I should know about so I can keep you mentally safe? And of course, do this in a confidential manner. I really had this flash this morning when I was watching, you know, those phenomenally athletic guys up on the stage this morning, thinking about like the soccer moms in my community watching that same demonstration and going like, oh no, never. I could never do that. Role models are so critically important in this area. For women to feel like they can overcome all those obstacles we talked about, they need to see themselves overcoming it. They need to see an instructor who embodies the overcoming of those obstacles. So it's someone that they find familiar, that they can identify with. So, you know, one of those guys might be an effective instructor, but it would be, I think, less than ideal if they were the only instructor. They need to be paired with a woman who resembles the population that you're working with. You know, Kathy Long is going to be a dynamite fighter. She's going to be devastating, and she's a woman. But she's more devastating than I think any of us would be without her years and years of training. So even another woman, if she's not someone that people can easily identify with, might not be the ideal choice. You have to prepare your instructors for all of these things that we've just talked about. Training of your instructors, particularly your male instructors, because they have not experienced the socialization that women have experienced, is crucial. They have to understand the emotional and physical components of what happens to students when they progress through this training. But they really have to understand those statistics, understand the dynamics of assault, what's different between women and men and how they're assaulted in their body mechanics and the likely assailant that they're going to have to be defending themselves against. And you want to be really sure that those instructors are prepared to keep clear and appropriate boundaries with their students. You don't want, God forbid, your instructors becoming abusive with your students. I don't want any instructor to be having too much fun enacting a rape scenario with a student. I don't want any instructor being really enthusiastic about pretending to assault somebody. I want an instructor who takes this with tremendous seriousness and commitment and really is doing this for the benefit of the student. And the instructor that I've seen, the padded attackers and the other self-defense instructors who put their bodies on the line so that women can learn skills, are some of the most extraordinarily generous men I have ever encountered, because they're willing to give their bodies to women so that women can learn to be safer. And that's phenomenal. You want to be really supportive with these students. They need more support than your typical martial arts student does. You really need to be constantly encouraging them and sending those messages of empowerment that I mentioned. And again, I feel that that is your responsibility as instructors. I'm not going to speak about what other training methods you might be using in other classes. I hope this isn't happening anywhere. But if it's happening anywhere, it can't happen in these classes. It will only serve to undermine everything you're trying to accomplish and prevent these women from actually using the skills you're working so hard to teach them if you're harsh and critical with them in classes. So you need really good instructors. You need really good instructors who are really good communicators, who are very respectful to their students. I encourage you to provide access to other resources to your students. In the impact classes, the self-defense classes I participated in and taught in, we do an opening and a closing circle. We process the experience of participating in the class, what the students' needs and issues are. The instructors are given a lot of training on how to do that with the students. If you or the instructors in your school don't feel comfortable doing that, that's okay. Bring somebody in who does feel comfortable doing that. Team up with a rape crisis center, with a women's resource center, with a local therapist, with a social worker, with someone who's got those skills. Have them do an opening program and maybe a closing program. Or have them meet with the women in the class, you know, halfway through and then at the end to kind of make sure everybody's comfortable and they're processing those psychological issues. I don't expect everybody here to be psychologists, but you guys have got great resources in all of your communities. I promise you, if you call a rape crisis center or a women's resource center and say, hey, I want to do this and I want to do it really well, and I need your help, they will really respect you for that. And I would offer, you know, some kind of resource list to all of your students as a matter of course. Don't wait for a student to come to you and say, I was the victim of an assault, who do I talk to? Because everyone in your class might have been a victim and not tell you. So you want to just put those resources out there as part of your plan to empower these women in every way you can. Should you have a student who really kind of loses it in a class, who has an extreme emotional reaction, who really has a flashback, you want to be prepared for that. I think it would be a rare occurrence if you're conducting your class in the manner that we've described. You want to provide ample support. You, of course, have gotten some kind of an emergency contact number, because I know you all do that, because you have good release forms and you're getting good emergency contact information.